It's Wednesday, January 22, 2014. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Today, the 22nd of January, 2014, is the 41st anniversary of one of the darkest days in American history, the day that the United States Supreme Court handed down the Roe v. Wade decision legalizing abortion on demand. Since that date, almost 55 million unborn babies have been aborted in American wombs. That is almost the total population of Italy. It surpasses the total population of South Africa. We're talking about an entire modern nation missing after Roe v. Wade, missing by murder in the womb, and missing now 41 years after that decision was handed down. At my website at albertmoeller.com, I published an article yesterday entitled Abortion and the American Conscience. And my point in that article is this: 40 plus years after Roe v. Wade, America is not less, but actually more divided over the issue of abortion. And when we think about the great moral shift that has been taking place in America over the last 40 years, indeed over the last half century, when you think about the secularization of the American worldview, the one great exception in the direction that America had been heading morally for so long is the issue of abortion. It can be now argued and documented that America in 2014 is more pro-life than it was in the year 1973. One of the things we note as we look back with a retrospective of over four decades is that back in 1973, most Americans, including most evangelical Christians, had never seriously considered the issue of abortion. Abortion blew up as an American issue, as a great political and moral crisis, basically because of political pressure from the two coasts and from some isolated issues in the heartland of America, especially political forces within cities very close to American universities. But when the decision was handed down, on January the 22nd, 1973, the Supreme Court of the United States stated emphatically that it intended to settle the issue. And of course, we now know in retrospect that it sought to settle the issue by making abortion on demand legal from coast to coast. We also know several things about the Roe v. Wade decision that we didn't know back in 1973. The availability of the papers of the justices, especially the papers of Associate Justice Harry Blackmun, who wrote that majority opinion back in 1973. The reality is we know several things that are of crucial importance. Number one, we know that Harry Blackmun invented the entire issue of trimesters out of the blue. He simply came up with this rubric of three trimesters in order to try to argue for a state's increasing power to control abortion as the baby grew larger in the womb and moved closer towards live birth. The next thing we know from his own papers is that he was committed to finding a legal right for abortion and then went looking in the Constitution in order to try to find an argument. He, along with the law clerks who enabled him to write the majority opinion, actually went shopping for a legal theory to use in this case. We also know something else. This came in the midst of the great concern popular amongst the elites in America in the 1970s about a supposed population explosion. There were all kinds of issues that went into this, but the central push in terms of America in the early 1970s came from the feminist movement, with the explicit argument, an argument that is embedded within the very text of the Roe v. Wade decision, that the main reason why a woman has a supposed constitutional right to an abortion is because she must be given control over reproductive destiny as the central issue in her pregnancy. In other words, the central legal issue in the pregnancy, the Supreme Court declared 41 years ago today, is not the baby inside the woman who's expecting it, but rather her own personal autonomy and her determination to be a mother or not to be a mother. But again, the other great fact about abortion in the early 1970s is the fact that most Americans really hadn't thought through the issue at all. And to our great shame, that included the vast majority of American evangelicals. As a matter of fact, up into the mid-1970s, most evangelicals sought not to be involved in the issue. As with the birth control issue, evangelicals made a hasty mistake deciding that this must be a Catholic issue. And to their credit, Roman Catholics were largely those who populated the pro-life movement in the 1960s up to the midpoint of the 1970s. But all that changed in the last 5 years of the 1970s. Evangelicals became awakened to the issue of the sanctity of human life, and this came in the context of other cultural and moral changes as well. This came in the context of an increased understanding of what was happening in America with the rise of no-fault divorce, with the largely universal reality of the birth control culture, with the understanding that children themselves were being devalued and the family was being marginalized. But it was the understanding of the moral status of the baby in the womb that helped to awaken evangelicals to the grave threat to the sanctity of every single human life that legal abortion then represented. This led, of course, to a great pro-life resurgence that had effects all the way from the 1980 presidential election, the first election in which abortion was a crucial issue between presidential candidates, all the way to the realignment of American politics and moral life throughout the last several decades, and right to the 2014 off-year elections, those mid-year elections, and that point made emphatically in yesterday's edition on the front page of the New York Times. Before turning to that New York Times article, I want to look at The New Yorker, an article that appeared yesterday by Ben Margot, in which he also deals with the fact that abortion is still an issue. He writes this: controversies, even intense ones, come and go in American politics. At the turn of the 20th century, no issue was more passionately debated than prohibition. Now that's a non-issue. A decade or two hence, thanks to the experiments now starting in Colorado and Washington State, it's possible to think that marijuana legalization might also become uncontroversial. Certainly, he writes, same-sex marriage is heading in this direction. It's not yet legal everywhere, but it will be before too long, and the passion is draining out of the opposition. He writes that in order to say this, quote, but 40 years after Roe v. Wade, the intensity of the abortion debate has not waned. Indeed, as these cases illustrate, the controversy grows and spreads into new areas that are logically unrelated to abortion itself. This American struggle never ends, end quote. Meanwhile, on the other side of the cultural divide, Chuck Donovan, writing at National Review, says this: two primary facts emerge from a new analysis of state legislation regarding abortion over the past 3 years. First, elections matter. Second, and this is a very crucial issue in his article, second, 41 years on from Roe v. Wade, a majority of states where a majority of U.S. women live support new limits and protections for mothers and unborn children, rather than the permissive legal regime declared by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1973. That is a phenomenally important sentence. As he says, a majority of the states where a majority of U.S. women live now clearly support new limits and protections not only for mothers but for their unborn children. He goes on and writes, the state legislative surge for life has strong prospects for at least the remainder of this decade. First, it represents the results of redistricting decisions that will be with us until 2020. Second, and more importantly in terms of worldview consideration, he says, quote, it follows an independent surge in pro-life opinion, end quote. In other words, this surge in pro-life opinion isn't particularly tied to a political identity or to one's political self-identification. In other words, there is a surge in pro-life sentiment even among those who classify themselves as liberals on many other issues and who may genuinely be quite liberal on issues ranging from the legalization of marijuana to the endorsement of same-sex marriage. This is one issue that is running counter, at least in many manifest ways, to the larger moral revolution. He then writes this sentence, which is fully supportable by the evidence. Finally, he writes, the specific pro-life measures being adopted in the states are, in the vast majority of instances, supported by strong, even supermajority percentages of Americans, end quote. I simply want to add to that, that's not a particularly new development. All the way back into the early 1970s with Roe v. Wade, there were vast majorities of Americans who believed that abortion should remain illegal and unattainable under certain circumstances, that young women who are minors should have parental permission or at least parental notification in order to have an abortion. There was a vast public sentiment and still is in favor of the elimination of so-called partial birth abortions. One thing has become clear in terms of the moral sentiment of Americans: the more the unborn child resembles a living baby, the more pro-life the American moral instinct then becomes. The Christian worldview reminds us that every single human life is fully human, fully sacred, fully deserving of our protection from the moment of conception until natural death. At every moment of human development, that human life is equally sacred and deserves our full and equal protection. But it does tell us something, that Americans tend now to be very pro-life at the end of a pregnancy, somewhat pro-life at every point of the pregnancy. But the sliding scale there tells us that we still have a great deal of work to do. I mentioned that article by Jeremy Peters at the New York Times earlier. He writes, quote, abortion is becoming an unexpectedly animating issue in the 2014 midterm elections. Republicans, through state ballot initiatives and legislation in Congress, are using it to stoke enthusiasm among core supporters. Democrats, mindful of how potent the subject has been in recent campaigns, like last year's governor's race in Virginia, are looking to rally female voters by portraying their conservative opponents as callous on women's issues, end quote. Representative Steve Israel of New York, the chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, said, quote, Republicans have turned the floor of the House into the battleground for their relentless war on women's health care and freedoms. Every time they launch another extreme attack against women's rights, they lose more ground with women voters, end quote. Now, that's a very interesting point. Is it true? Well, first of all, as we discussed just days ago, the use of the word extreme here, as is always the case, frankly, whether you find it on the left or the right, it says more about the person speaking than about the people of whom the person is speaking. When the word extreme or extremist is used here, it almost never is actually referring to anything that is extreme or to anyone who's rightly defined as extremist. As I said, the key issue here on the part of the Democrats, as seemingly affirmed by the New York Times in this article, is that whenever the issue of abortion comes up, women voters are alienated and are then more likely to vote for a Democratic candidate. Later in the article, we find this paragraph, quote, nowhere was the power of the abortion issue more evident recently than in the governor's race in Virginia, where the Democratic candidate, Terry McAuliffe, won in November in part because women preferred him by 9 percentage points over the Republican, Ken Cuccinelli, whom Democrats portrayed as extreme on women's issues, end quote. Well, when I read that article in yesterday's edition of the New York Times, I saw that it was right, except where it was colossally wrong. And in this case, where it's wrong is in what's missing. What's missing is an acknowledgement that it's not just the women's vote that's crucial here, but which women are voting. Long ago in the briefing, right after the November elections, I went to the election results and looked carefully at this and talked about it on this program. There is an incredible distinction in the voters of Virginia among the women voters between those who were women who were married and those who were unmarried. Women who were married voted overwhelmingly for the Republican candidate, Ken Cuccinelli, the pro-life candidate, rather than for Terry McAuliffe, the Democratic candidate who was pro-abortion or, in his words, pro-choice. In other words, marital status of the woman voter turned out to be an even more interesting angle than the gender issue taken alone. The New York Times acts as if this was simply a women's issue, but it's not simply a women's issue, as was reflected in the very article I cited earlier, demonstrating once again that these state restrictions on abortion being adopted represent the states where most American women live. One other issue, very clear issue, on that New York Times report from yesterday, all of the animating issues related to abortion, as are reflected in that story, had to do with politics and political calculation. You would think that the issue of abortion is merely a political issue and that one's position on the abortion issue is simply a political determination. Wrong. Veteran journalist Terry Mattingly, writing at Get Religion, makes very clear that what's missing in this article are the religious and theological convictions that undergird one's position on abortion, either for or against. In particular, what's missing from this article is the understanding that the vast army of those in the pro-life movement aren't animated by a political agenda, but rather by a conviction that every single human life is sacred and worthy of dignity and honor and protection precisely because every single human being at every stage of development is made in God's image. As Mattingly writes, this story does cover a lot of ground, but the reporters are following a strictly political map. At several times, it was easy to spot the ghosts that the Times team either didn't see or made a conscious decision to avoid. End quote. A very interesting analysis of this article, and it gets right to the heart of the worldview considerations on abortion. This really is about one's understanding of the value of human life, born and unborn. It really does get to one's understanding of whether or not an individual has the personal autonomy to determine who shall live and who shall die, even the unborn child in the womb. It really does get to issues that are inescapably, even in a secular age, theological. Terry Mattingly writes, it's safe to say that the majority of the marchers, he's talking about today's March for Life in Washington, will be there for reasons that are based in part on their religious convictions. In the United States of America and lots of other places, that is the statistical reality, end quote. And to that we need to add, these are not merely religious convictions. These are explicitly Christian convictions. Convictions that are deeply rooted in the Christian worldview and in the distinctively biblical understanding of the value of human life. Every human life at every stage of development. Finally, shifting to the church, and particularly to what could be learned from a recent issue of the Church of England, Andrew Brown, writing in his column at The Guardian, that's a left-wing British newspaper, writes a column entitled, quote, when it comes to church growth, it's not the theology, stupid. He goes on and says, evangelicals like to think their beliefs boost numbers, but really it's because they take growth seriously, a lesson liberals could learn. So what's his point? His point is that the general received wisdom about church growth or church decline is that it is the more liberal churches that are declining and the more conservative churches that have been, until at least recently, either growing or holding their own. And then he writes, now, one of the most persistent myths about contemporary Christianity is that only evangelical churches grow while liberal Christianity is doomed because it's too wishy-washy. This is believed with pleasure by evangelicals, he writes, with despair by aging liberals, and without thought by the chattering classes. As you'd expect, he continues, it's nonsense, and we have just had more proof. End quote. Well, if it's nonsense, we should want to know about it, but as it turns out, it's his suggestion of nonsense that turns out to be, unsurprisingly, nonsense. He writes about this data, saying it comes from a conference on church growth, as the Church of England calls the field of church decline. He does write with a certain verve. To consider the latest and most accurate statistics on the matter, he writes, the demographics of the Church of England mean that even staying still is a recipe for future catastrophe. The average age of congregations is now 62. Only one child in 10 is now baptized in Anglican, he says. It has also emerged from this conference that very nearly half of the congregations in England have fewer than 5 members under 16. Let's just interject, that does spell disaster, and that's disaster with a capital D. He then asks, so which churches are growing? The surveys, he says, ask the clergy to rank themselves as evangelical, conservative, and charismatic, compared to being Catholic, liberal, and, well, non-charismatic. At first sight, he says, the results suggested a slight bias in the direction of conventional wisdom, in that evangelicals, conservatives, and charismatics were slightly more likely to have growing churches, but he says that disappeared when other factors, get this, listen carefully, such as age, time in the job, leadership styles. Once those are taken out, the correlation disappeared. Other things being equal, he writes, theological style and belief make no difference at all. What's needed to make churches grow, he says, is that they should want to, and that the congregation should take the task seriously. Well, you look at this, and I did look at the underlying data, and what does it tell us? It tells us that the point he's trying to make is actually not embedded in the research at all. But there is something very interesting in the main point he wants to make. He says, it's about the determination to grow. And if even liberal churches had the determination to grow, they could grow just like conservative churches. Because it's the ambition to grow, he says, that is the point. He says it's not about theology, but merely about the determination and strategy to grow. But that's where the data coming from the mainline liberal churches actually comes back to make the first point and destroy his second. In other words, it really is, in one sense, about the determination to grow. But that is, as the second point makes clear, it really is a determination to grow for theological reasons, for reasons of conviction and urgent evangelistic concern. It turns out, as the study entitled Vanishing Boundaries, paid for by the Presbyterian Church USA, documented years ago, that the main dividing line between the denominations and between individual congregations is between those who believe that eternal destiny is at stake in terms of sharing the gospel and reaching people with the message of salvation, and those who really believe that it doesn't make all that much difference. As a matter of fact, those authors of the study, Vanishing Boundaries, said the big issue for the liberal churches is that there isn't any impetus to grow. But why isn't there any impetus to grow? Because there's no particular reason to be a member of their church. Nothing is fundamentally at stake. Heaven and hell? Not a big concern. Eternal destiny? Not on the radar screen. Church growth? Why grow? Why come to church in the first place? It turns out, in other words, that these statistics about church growth and church decline really do point to something very fundamental. You can take his point that it's really about the desire or ambition to grow. But if you're thinking that's just about church growth, you're really missing the larger point. Looking at the data more closely reveals that there is a deep theological conviction that underlies the determination as to whether or not the church should reach out into the community, should tell people about Jesus, should reach out with the gospel, should send missionaries and evangelists. All this comes down to whether or not there is a basic confidence in the gospel, understanding that eternal realities are at stake, eternal destiny is on the line. In other words, what we find out by looking at this research is what you thought from the beginning. This is about theology. Now, about that matter of theology, it turns out, if you do look at much of this data, that evangelical churches are actually following many of the mainline churches into decline. What does that tell us? It's just about demographics? No, that tells us that we better be very careful that we understand why it is that evangelical churches are named evangelical. It's about a commitment to the gospel. If that is lost, we will not grow, nor should we. Before I close, I want to invite you to join me, along with nationally syndicated radio host Dennis Prager and New York Times columnist Ross Douthat, for a conversation about faith and freedom in the public square. We're going to talk about the issues we talk about just about every day on The Briefing. We're going to cover the waterfront and talk about how we should think about these issues and do so in the context of what it means to engage these questions in the public square. Our goal is to have an open and honest dialogue about the challenges we face as a nation and a civilization. Join us January 28th, that's next Tuesday, at 7 o'clock p.m. on the campus of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. For tickets and more information, go to #pros.com. That's #pros.com. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.